Hello, everyone. My name's Tina Dare, and I want to welcome you to the Surge Network's Faith, Work, and Rest podcast, where we explore what it means to glorify God and love our neighbor through our daily work and rest.
A liturgy for listening to podcasts. As I select a podcast, Spirit, direct my heart to what I need today. As I dial in the volume in my headphones, tune my ears to hear what you have to say. As I hear the familiar voice of the host, let the familiar warmth of your presence stir up the security I have in you. In a world filled with many voices, give me discernment as I listen. Train my heart to clash against that which contradicts what is good, beautiful, and true. And yet open my eyes wider to see how your truth is bigger and broader than I often imagine. I confess that my perspectives are limited. If something in this podcast reveals how my blind spots have kept me from being faithful to you, gently guide me in repentance. And yet I also confess that even when I have the right view of things, my hands are slow to act on behalf of the overlooked. O Spirit of the risen Christ, animate my life so that my perspectives don't lie impotent in my mind, but fill up the spaces that you've given me to steward. From Psalm 19. But who can discern their own errors? Forgive my hidden faults. Keep your servant also from willful sins. May they not rule over me. Then I will be blameless, innocent of great transgression. May these words of my mouth and this meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, Lord, my rock and my redeemer. I am so excited for this podcast today with Douglas McKelvey as we talk about story, liturgy, the vocation of writing. I think it'll stir all of our imaginations for what it means to live in light of God's presence in all that we do. I'm here today with Doug McKelvey. He's a lyricist, author, and someone who I've come to greatly respect. Thank you so much for being here today with us.
Thank you, Tina. Happy to be here.
Okay, so before we get into some more of our content, can you just share more of your little bio, like your family and some more of your work?
Sure. So I moved to Nashville, Tennessee shortly after college. It was at the invitation of recording artist and producer Charlie Peacock. He and his wife were, this was in the early 90s, were just launching a nonprofit venture called The Art House. That was a shared exploration of the intersection of faith and art. And so within a couple of years of being in Nashville and working with Charlie, he asked if I wanted to try some songwriting with him, where I would write the lyric and he would write the music. And that led to a handful of cuts on a project he was producing and writing. And so from there, that opened doors for me in the music industry in Nashville. So for 12 or 15 years, I was a song lyricist as my primary vocation. But it was during those years that Napster became a thing and people quit buying music. You know, suddenly 90% of the music people were getting was illegally downloaded rather than purchased. So at that point, I realized that I wasn't going to be able to, you know, continue to support a growing family on royalty income, because they're just, within the space of a couple of years, it seemed like there was about 25% of the income that there had been from song royalties. So I started looking around, went to LA, took some screenwriting courses, transitioned into doing video and film work for a few years. But along the way, actually, even the same week that I had signed my first songwriting deal, I had also done my first book deal. It was a momentous week.
Yeah, to say the least.
So I had published a handful of books along the way over the years, but video work, which tends to ebb and flow based on the economy, had dried up a lot. And so I found myself, you know, driving for Uber and Lyft, and took a position doing the setup and tear down at my church. And so it was for me, it was emotionally difficult season.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, okay, at this point in my life, I feel like I'm suddenly just, you know, scrabbling to try to make ends meet or to try to not to go into debt faster. And, you know, what was all this about? This, you know, the time that I spent in the music industry writing songs. And, you know, it was a time when I had to face a lot of my feelings about, have I missed all my opportunities? Am I just, have I failed? Am I never going to really do the kinds of things vocationally and create the kinds of things that I'd hope to? But during those years, I had gotten more and more involved with the Rabbit Room community. And Rabbit Room is a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to fostering Christ-centered community through story, music, and art. There is a conference every year in Nashville. It's called Hutchmoot. And I had been invited to speak on a panel about filmmaking several years ago. And that was my first introduction really to that community, other than that I had written a couple of things for the Rabbit Room website. And I went there thinking, oh, this is just going to be a bunch of Christian music industry wannabe artists who are trying to get close to some of the people like Andrew Peterson, you know, in hopes of furthering their own career.
Not cynical at all, no.
And I was, well, it's true. I won't try to give any explanations. It's true. But I was so pleasantly surprised and blown away really by what was actually happening there. And to see that, no, that's not at all why these people are here. These are people from all walks of life. The common denominator was this, there was this common love of a certain type of redemptive storytelling in all its forms, whether that was through visual arts or theater or film or the novels of people like Tolkien and, you know, or songs. And it was people who were passionate about those things and their power to communicate because of how those kinds of artifacts in the culture had impacted them personally. So it was this very thoughtful and diverse group of people in terms of the walks of lives that they were coming from, who had this shared passion and a desire to amplify those things. So it was a community that that from within the community, those kinds of cultural artifacts were being created. And then the community was acting as this amplifier, you know, talking about them, being excited about them, funding them on Kickstarter, you know, to make things happen. And so I was just seized with that community as I began to experience it. And so over a several year period, I became more and more involved with that community. But as I was becoming integrated into this Rabbit Room community and being given a voice in it, at a certain point, I realized, okay, I've spent so many years chasing the writing of things that I hoped would be that thing that would finally pay the bills, would finally move us from a hand to mouth, month to month, sort of wondering, you know, okay, how are we going to pay the mortgage this month? And just the stress of that family. But at that point, I realized, you know, that has been my focus, and yet it hasn't paid off. What if I really look at this in terms of, okay, I'm a part of this community. What would it mean to make art, to produce artifacts to serve this community? And not to do that with an eye on, is this going to sell? But just to say, okay, even if I don't make money off of this, can I create something that will be me stewarding the gifts I've been given in order to serve the community around me? And that was a big shift in my thinking. So then I began to try to think in terms of what would serve this community and to try to create those things. And so I began to focus much more on the idea of books. I was finding, you know, the video world was, I mean, there were things I enjoyed about it, but it was very high stress.
Yeah, I imagine.
And ultimately the Every Moment Holy project, was something that was birthed out of that community and for that community. But as I think can often happen, if you create something that actually does serve a given community, then it probably is going to resonate with people outside of that community as well.
Mm. Yeah, right? Wow, that's like such an important, with vocation, when we're doing it for the sake of love for people that we know, when there's that sense of knowing and loving and longing to serve, that's when there's that shift, like you said, that takes place. That's really helpful. And then gold was produced. Every Moment Holy is pure gold. You don't have to say it. I will. So for our listeners who don't have a copy yet, this is a book of liturgies. So let's just, I want to hear from you. Were liturgies a part of the Christian tradition that you came from? What is a liturgy? Was this something that the community you were a part of with the Rabbit Room? Like, tell us about how you came to write a book of liturgies.
Well, for people who aren't that familiar with what the term might actually mean, there's the very specific meaning of the word liturgy that refers to the order and the content of a church service. And in that sense, there is no church that doesn't have a liturgy, even if their liturgy is, okay, we're just going to show up and people are going to spontaneously start praying. And then someone might, start singing a song and the rest of us will sing it. And then, even a church that builds their service around trying to make most of it spontaneous, that is still their liturgy. That's their way of doing it, of ordering and structuring the service. So there's that very specific sense. And then the term gets used, if you hear the term a liturgical church, that's usually referring to Catholic or Anglican or Episcopal or Orthodox, some segment of Christianity where they have this very highly ordered, often, collected in something like the Book of Common Prayer, where you have these prayers and orders for service that have been, in some cases, shaped over hundreds of years, that where you can have these very theologically rich and often, somewhat poetic kind of phrasings that have been distilled, these truths of the gospel that have been distilled over long periods of time and affirmed by generation after generation of believers within the church, that yes, this is an expression of truth and we can stand on this. But then you have the broader sense of liturgies being the rhythms of our lives. They're those things that, because we do them repeatedly, they have power over time to shape or to misshape our hearts, because liturgy in that sense isn't just a positive term. It can be a negative term. I've used the example before when I was speaking to a group that a 13-year-old habitually posting dozens of selfies a day, that could become, I'm not saying it's wrong to post selfies, but that can become over time a liturgy that trains the heart toward caring too much about what other people think, mm-hmm. and how other people are going to respond to me, and are they going to like, you know, and that has a very different shaping power, to have that rhythm in your life than, you know, say to have a habit of, you know, frequently going out at night and putting a blanket out on the grass and laying down and just mm-hmm. looking up at the stars and kind of pondering creation and the magnitude of what's been created and how that can shape your heart toward an awe for God and a sense of wonder at his creation and at his being. And again, it's not to say that, hey, if you post a selfie, that's wrong, but it's about those rhythms and patterns and those liturgies that we find ourselves engaging in, either intentionally or just by default, because yeah. it's the easy thing to do. And those things that we do, they impact the way we move through the world. They impact ultimately our theology, and, you know, it filters down into the choices that we make and the ways that we live our lives.
Yeah, no, that's great. And so you wrote these with the Rabbit Room community in mind. What was it that you were hearing or seeing or experiencing that said, okay, I need to devote some time to this?
I had the thought that I really need a prayer that I could pray each morning when I sit down to write that would reorient my heart in relation to who I am, to my creator, to that relationship, and to my responsibility of stewarding the gifts that I've been entrusted with to steward during this life, and also to reorient my mind and heart in relation to why I'm doing what I'm doing, to this relationship to the people that I'm hoping to serve by what I'm trying to create here. So when I had that thought, I thought, okay, I'm gonna write a prayer for fiction writing. And then because I've dabbled in poetry over the years and found that I like what I create better if I impose a form on the front end, where it's like, okay, I have to adhere to this kind of structure. And I just thought, I'm gonna do this in a liturgical kind of structure where there are parts for a leader to pray and then for the people to respond. I gave myself, you know, the added assignment of writing that prayer for fiction writers as a liturgy. So, I ended up with a liturgy for fiction writers, and I thought, oh, well, that's, you know, I'll use this. That's a cool thing. But a Hutchmoot conference was coming up in a couple months, and I was going to be doing a session, speaking at a session along with Andrew Peterson and Heidi Johnston. And I sent that to Andrew just to say, hey, would this be a good way for us to close this session on story? And he emailed me back and said, yeah, I love this, but man, I wish I had a liturgy for beekeeping. And he named a couple other things. And it was just like, oh, of course. This isn't just like a one-off novelty kind of prayer. There's actually something here that could really serve the church.
Yeah.
And so I got to work writing up a proposal and, you know, making a brainstorm list of different potential topics for it. And it was like the whole concept just, you know, was there all at once. Like it was just waiting for us to stumble across it. And so I pitched that idea to the folks at Rabbit Room Press, and they immediately said, yes, but we're a really small press. And, you know, it's going to cost $60,000 to do a first printing of this sort of book with the way we would want to print it, with the hardback, leather, gilding, you know, silk bookmark, all of that. And we don't have that kind of money. So we're telling you yes, but we'll have to wait till we can figure out how to finance the initial printing. So then the next year at Hutchmoot, we introduced the idea to the community there, which would have been about 400 people. And they just immediately started giving money. And this was not a Kickstarter. They weren't getting anything. They weren't even being told you will get a copy of the book if you donate money. But people just, I mean, some were just walking up with cash, you know, and saying, I want this to exist in the world.
Wow.
You know, I want to be a part of this becoming a real thing. And, you know, we need this. The world needs this. Let's do this together. And so, you know, it was the Rabbit Room community that made it happen. There was a donor who stepped up and said, I know you need to pay your bills during the time that you're writing this. Here's, you know, it gave a substantial gift to free up time for me to be able to devote to the writing of it. And then the community was very involved in, we opened up the potential subject matter to them and said, you know, give us your ideas for parts of life you would want to have a prayer for. And so, you know, probably at least a quarter of the liturgies that are in the book are ones that other people suggested an idea for. So it really was a project that was created for community, embraced by that community, made possible by that community. And then, you know, that same community are the ones who have just been so responsible for the organic spread of it. So it's just, it's been a pretty amazing thing. It's not anything I can claim ownership of or having masterminded. It's just been, you know, a humbling thing and a beautiful thing just to see Christian community at work in that way, you know, having a vision together that we want to create this thing and offer it as a gift to the church and the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe even have it be something that will be here after we're gone, that, you know, is still a gift that we got to be a part of giving.
Oh man, what a stark contrast between what you were describing when you were just individually trying to, you know, make it work, make ends meet. Yeah, it sounded lonely that when you were doing that type of writing, and then to enter into a community and to see the incredible power and beauty of community of believers partnering. Because there isn't competition. There's a common vision and goal to see the church and the world flourish and live into the good news of the gospel. And so there's this partnership that transcends any individual pursuits. How beautiful. That's really special. So in your liturgies, you have a whole section on labor and vocation. I'm going to read just a section from one of those. And then we can discuss. So this is a liturgy for medical providers, which I think is, maybe more than ever, medical providers need to just have that connection with God in their work right now. So it says, O Christ, our healer, there is no end to malady, sickness, injury, and disease in this broken world. So there is no end to the line of hurting people who daily need my tending. Therefore, give me grace, O God, that I might be generous with my kindness, and that in this healing and caretaking vocation, my hands might become an extension of your hands, and my service a conduit for your mercy. For it is often not an easy place to be, so near to suffering, to injury, to pain, to emergency and fear and confusion, and sometimes even to dying and death and grief. But I believe it is exactly the sort of place you would be, O Lord, amongst those who hurt.
So let my practice of medicine be centered in an understanding of your heart. Let me practice medicine because you are a healing God who feels compassion and extends mercy. Let me practice medicine because you are near to those who are in need, to those who face grief and loss. Let me practice medicine as a willing servant of your redemption, pushing back by means of my vocation the effects of the fall. Let my presence in this place lend a human face to your compassion. And I'll stop there, but the prayer is really beautiful as it continues. Help us with words like that. Help us see how we can grow in our vision for how our work flows directly from God's work in the world.
All of the prayers in Every Moment Holy, I think in one way or another, are about the unpacking of what it means to, there's a phrase, practice the presence of God, which really means practicing a mindfulness of the presence of God, because we know that he is present in all places and at all moments. So it's more about that habit of our own heart and thoughts and awareness in a given moment of recognizing his presence. And so writing these prayers, among many other things that it was, one of the things that I recognized along the way that it was for me was an exercise in unpacking different moments. To say, okay, if I believe this truth, which I do, that God is present in every moment and wants to use all things for the good of his children and for the advancing of his kingdom, then how does this moment intersect with the kingdom of God? And in what ways might the Spirit of God be present and active in this? So, you know, there are a number of different vocations that I wrote prayers for, including the one for medical providers that you just read from. And the first one, actually the first prayer I wrote that's in the book, is a liturgy for fiction writers. But then there are several other of those vocational kind of liturgies in the book. I wanted to offer something specifically to the people who are involved in those vocations, but I also hoped that it would be kind of a vision shaping tool for the rest of us who aren't medical providers, but to read that and to see through those eyes of how does this particular vocation advance the kingdom of God through those of his servants who are involved in it. And as a means of helping the rest of us, you know, develop this more perceptive vision moment to moment of recognizing that, okay, if God is at work in these moments and through people laboring in these vocations, he's pleased to advance his kingdom. How's he doing that through my vocation and my involvement in it? And one of my favorite prayers in the book is a liturgy for those who work in wood and stone and metal and clay. And I know people who do work, you know, it's their primary vocation, working in those various crafts and artisan kind of works. And so I wanted to write something that was specifically for them, but that prayer emerged as this call to my own heart. And I hoped to the body of Christ more broadly, because the refrain that emerged in that prayer was, I am practicing the new, or I am rehearsing the new creation. Now I'm not even remembering the phrasing exactly. I'm rehearsing the new creation in the making of this thing. And I think that same thing applies for medical providers or for any of our vocations. It's about coming to recognize that we are day by day, moment by moment, rehearsing the new creation. We are living in light of the kingdom that is coming and the redemption that is coming. And, you know, it changes everything to begin to grasp that paradigm in a more day-by-day kind of way, and to recognize that I might have to do something mundane today. A couple months back, I was ripping up the old wood flooring in a house, and it took me 12 days of up to 16-hour days of just brutal labor.
Wow.
And it's one thing just to approach that as drudgery and as something I don't want to be doing, but it's a very different thing if I can look at it in with an eternal perspective in the light of the coming kingdom of God, and recognizing that this work, as much as I would rather not be doing it right now, that it has context in this larger story, and that in this restoration work that I'm doing to restore something and to make it beautiful and useful to serve the people who will occupy this space in the years to come, and creating this space for fellowship to happen among people, and for the creativity that will happen there, and the love that will be expressed, that this physical act of ripping out an old wood floor, I can recognize as a rehearsal of the new creation in this task.
Oh, yeah, I have over my diaper changing station one of your liturgies for changing diapers. Was one and two, was that intended to be a play on a...
it was not. You're not the first person who's asked that. I guess I should have anticipated that it might be interpreted that way.
Even content-wise, the number two fits with the messier side of changing diapers.
I never tried to unpack all of those hidden layers of meaning. No, I think it was actually because as I was writing that one, at a certain point, I realized it's much too long to be of good service to people. And, you know, you don't want to spend several minutes saying a prayer before you actually get to the task of changing the diaper. So, you know, once I realized it was too long, I looked at it more carefully and saw, okay, there are really two main points that it's, you know, or two main directions that it's going in this prayer, and I'll just separate those two.
So good.
And then Ned Bustard, who does the wonderful and theologically, symbolically rich illustrations for the project, he also did the layout. And some of the scriptures, the verses that show up in the columns alongside the liturgies, he chose during that process. And so until the book was published, I didn't see that for the diaper changing one, he had used the verse about "we will not all sleep, but we will all be changed."
Yes.
So, illustrator humor, I guess.
So good. So pertinent. And yes, his visuals in this book are just so beautiful and enriching. Yeah, it's really amazing. Okay, so much goodness for different vocations, like you said, whether our personal vocation is included in one of the liturgies or whether it's just awakening our imagination. And also you have a whole section for creation and recreation, for rest. And in this podcast, we try to really press into the fact that we both need to find intentionality and envision the kingdom both in our work, but also in our rest. Sometimes people maybe have an easier time with one or the other. And so one of my favorites is a liturgy for planting flowers. And I actually planted flowers for the first time just so I could read this liturgy with my family. I'm like, well, I gotta plant flowers now. So I want to read some of this and engage with it a little bit with you. So this is a leader and people set up. It says, "In a world shadowed by cruelty, violence, and loss, Is there good reason for planting of flowers? And the people say, ah, yes, for these bursts of colors and beautiful blooms are bright dabs of grace, witnesses to a promise, reminders of a spreading beauty more eternal and therefore stronger than any evil, than any grief, than any injustice or violence. And I could go on, but that opening line really just captures the essence of there is something in our rest and in awe of God's creation and beauty that we desperately need, because in our day-to-day work, we bump up against violence and loss and pain. So just talk about that, about the importance of reimagining our rest in light of the kingdom.
When you were reading that, it reminded me of an Alexander Solzhenitsyn quote that I came across decades ago, but that it stuck with me, and an idea that I've chewed on a lot. And he said, "One word of truth outweighs the whole world."
Mm.
And I think that's another way of saying what the opening lines of that liturgy are saying, which is this amazing thought that all of the evil and violence of this world is in the end, in the eternal perspective, when we can see all things rightly, that it's going to have less substance than the glorious beauty of one flower.
Hmm.
Right? That beauty is an eternal thing, that is a reflection of the heart of God and the beauty and creativity and wonder and lavish love and grace of the Creator. And evil and suffering are not going to have the final word. They're not going to exist forever. Those things will be forever removed from the order of the new creation, when God restores all things and the joy and the beauty and the wonder are eternal. It is those things that flow from the heart of God that are eternal and will be so much more eternally real than the evil, the injustice, the suffering that is not going to last. It's not going to last into eternity. Those things will be restored and made right. And so I think it's important in terms of the way we approach rest and creation and recreation to recognize that those are not just frivolous things.
Mm-hmm.
That we like to play, right? Human beings like to play. And we see that a lot of animals in the animal kingdom like to play as well. I just saw a video of pandas in the snow who had created like a toboggan slide down the hill and who would just amble up and lay out on their back and stretch out just to slide upside down the hill in the snow, and then would walk back up to the top of the run and do it again.
That's amazing.
And I have a friend who's a minister in the Church of Scotland. And when he was going through seminary, he wrote his doctoral thesis on the idea that creation itself springs from the play of the Trinity. Mm-hmm. Within the Trinity, there is this delight and this joy and this playfulness. And that creation springs from that. I don't claim to be enough of a theologian, to be able to unpack all of that, but I find it a fascinating thesis. I think certainly all love that exists because of the eternal upwelling of love that's generated within the Trinity of, you know, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit for one another. And so I don't think it's a stretch to consider that we have this desire to play because that's part of the image of God in us. And that, you know, other creatures in creation have this amusing desire just to frolic and to play, because there is this sense of joy and play in the heart of creation, woven through the fabric of it. And you know, it's easy for us to dismiss it as a childish thing in some contexts, but I love what G.K. Chesterton said about, I think he was talking about the sunrise, but he was, I think the broader context, and this would have been in the book Orthodoxy, I think. He's talking about how because of sin and the brokenness within us, that we have in some ways grown older than our Father, that we have lost the ability to delight in things the way that God delights in them. And just as a child, you know, might say again, if you're playing some game with them like peekaboo, that he posits the idea that, you know, perhaps the reason the sun rises every day is not because of something mechanical set in motion, but because every day God cries again, because he hasn't lost that sense of delight and wonder and joy in the creation that he's made. So, you know, I think that is, I mean, it's just hard to imagine a world. It's hard to imagine our lives without the cynicism and jadedness that has come from the many disappointments we've suffered and the many hurts that all of us have suffered, and the frustration at our own brokenness and seeming futility of our efforts to do so many things. But I think that intentional investment in times of rest and recreation are important to our theology and to the outworking of what we believe in that sense, because they are echoes of what Eden was intended to be, and they're foreshadowings of what the eternal city and life in the new creation will be. I don't know what else to say about that.
But. Oh no, that's great. Just seeing that without play and rest, we're not truly whole. We're not truly living fully into, you know, the true story. We're living in a different story where work or efficiency or something else is made into a God, into the ultimate aim of life. Because to know God is to know joy and wonder and love and rest and all of these things that he embodies and shares with us. Yeah, that's really beautiful. Okay, I've got one final question for you. This one's fun. Okay. So we've talked, you know, about your liturgies, but you're also a fiction writer. If you could just pick one fiction book that you've written and pick one chapter of that book for us to inhabit for the rest of the year. So all of us that are listening, or all the people of God, inhabit and live within this chapter of one of your books, what would it be? And how would that experience help to restore us, reform us, to be faithful in the world today?
So I was talking to someone about what tends to happen in fiction stories that I write. Recently, I was having that conversation because I realized at a certain point that my protagonists tend to be put in, you know, these very traumatic situations. Mm-hmm. Andrew Peterson a few years ago had invited me to write one of the short stories for the Wing Feather Tales compilation. And I ended up writing a novel length story for that. And that was never my intention, but I had started out with this incident where this man loses his daughter. She's kidnapped. And there was just this brief reference in, I think, the beginning of Andrew's first book about that incident. And you never hear of that man again in, you know, in the four books of the Wing Feather Saga. But as the father of three daughters, you know, that was my jumping off point to write my story within the universe Andrew had created. Mm-hmm. Because I was like, wait, are we just going to leave that guy there after suffering that kind of devastating loss? Mm-hmm. You know, I want to follow that character and see what his journey is, what kind of resolution he comes to, you know, where does life go from there? And it turns out that you can't actually give a character the space to take a journey like that and have it feel emotionally credible in the space of a short story. At least I couldn't. So I just kept following him, and it, you know, it took a novel length to reach that point. And my first work of fiction that I had published was in the mid 90s, I guess. And it was a middle grade reader called The Angel, New Papa and the Dog. Mm-hmm. And in that story, this young girl who's the protagonist, she lives out on the frontier with her father, and there's this flood that unexpectedly overtakes them, and she sees her father washed away in the swirling waters, and she's left alone in the house with floodwaters rising. And I think it would probably be the kind of the central incident from that story that just as you were asking the question, I pulled up my ebook copy of it here. I think I have the right place. But this is when she finds herself alone at night in the flood. There's a mule. Their neighbor's mule is sheltering there with her in the house, and she is, you know, trying to figure out how to get out, what to do, and then she's stopped in her tracks. And I'll just, this is a short passage, but I'll read this because I think it goes to the heart of what you're asking, and of in the midst of chaos and uncertainty in our lives and the many questions that come with that, what it actually is that we're longing for, which is, you know, the presence of God, in which we then can recognize that we weren't even asking the right questions, right? That God's presence itself is the answer to the deepest questions that our hearts were longing to ask. The angel was as still as a 100-year oak, its wings spread far above us in the night, its robes pure white and blinding, its skin like a burning copper flame. The hands of the angel were firm and sure, the face was as strong as any river, and the eyes seemed to blaze deeper than all eternity. I forgot about my plans to swim ashore with Thaddeus. I forgot my fear of drowning and my worry for Papa. I forgot everything but the angel. The angel looked into my eyes in a perfect stillness, stillness without words and a stillness without questions, but a stillness with more meaning than all words that were ever spoken and all questions that were ever asked. The angel knew me. I knew that. And the angel angel knew Papa and the dog, and the angel knew Thaddeus Frisco and Bartholomew and Mr. Craven and everyone in the whole town. And the angel knew old Noah, who had weathered a worse flood than ours. And the angel even knew my mama, who had died before I could remember. The angel didn't move or breathe a word to tell me any of this. I sat perfectly still and quiet in that light, and I just knew. And I knew in the same way that no matter what happened to us, even if it was time to close our eyes and take our hand and lead us down through the valley of the shadow of death where Mama had walked long ago, all was well. The angel was with us, the angel of the Lord.
Wow. Thank you so much for reading that. I think that's a great place to wrap up. Thank you so much just for your words and your perspectives and your willingness to just work alongside God's people in order to just build up the church. I'm very grateful for you.
Thank you, Tina.
Thank you so much for joining today's conversation. If you have any ideas, questions, reflections, feel free to leave us a comment on iTunes or reach out by email at info@faithworkrest.com.